Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Zero Poverty, Act Now. Find out about a campaign to combat hidden forms of poverty across the European continent. And stay tuned for episode 29 of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries. The Secretary General of Caritas Internationalis, Leslie Ann Knight, has been appointed as one of the ambassadors of the European Union's Year for Combating Poverty and Social Exclusion. 2010 has in fact been designated the focus of a continent-wide campaign to challenge stereotypes and raise awareness about the many different faces of poverty in our so-called developed countries. As part of that campaign earlier this year, the Brussels-based Caritas Europa launched its own effort to tackle poverty and social exclusion with a petition to be presented to European institutions calling for concrete changes to guarantee decent living conditions for all people on the continent. The Caritas campaign is ambitiously entitled Zero Poverty Act Now. With its own website, www.zeropoverty.org, aimed, it says, at anyone who agrees with the statement, poverty is a scandal.
And I think we have really to reflect about a new way to do economy, to build our society.
Father Ernie Gillen is president of Caritas Europa. I sat down with him to find out more about this year's anti-poverty campaign in Europe and about a recent call to European governments to live up to their commitments to the developing world as well.
Campaign Zero Poverty was launched by Caritas Europa in order to raise awareness within Caritas organizations all over Europe, but also within the citizens in Europe, that poverty is a reality. We cannot close our eyes not looking at poverty as it presents itself today. So what we did in that poverty paper, we are presenting three different instruments to analyze poverty, because a lot of people are asking, what is poverty? And then you can go from extreme poverty to the statistical poverty threshold lying within 60% of the median under which people are considered to be poor. So in the first instrument, we are trying to give an answer that poverty is a multidimensional phenomenon, and that you cannot reduce poverty to the material poverty. We know that loneliness, for example, is a big issue within elderly people, within people living in prisons, people living on the street. Some children today are very lonely. And the Holy Father, in his encyclical Caritas in Veritate, he was pointing out very clearly in one of the articles that loneliness might be one of the biggest issues when it comes to poverty today.
So it's a much more holistic vision than simply looking at the statistics.
That's true, because we know that today there are people, for example, who during a whole week do not have any social contact at all. When you are talking to people in Georgia, for example, they only have one contact with the home care service person from Caritas joining them once a week. The same is true for Azerbaijan or for other countries, but even in Germany or even in France, you have cases reported that elderly people have only once a week a contact with another person. And that's not about material poverty, but that's about personal relational poverty, not to speak about the spiritual poverty.
It's such a complex problem, though. How do you go about proposing solutions to so many different facets of the issue?
For us, it's very important to make people understand that it's a citizens' issue first and a state issue on the second phase. So each person can do something, and we cannot simply refer the poverty solutions to the governments or to the states, but we want to raise awareness in our societies, in our communities, that they are able to bring solutions to people in need. They simply have to open their eyes and look, are there people around? Talk to people, accepting that every person is a human being, whether that person is living in the street, whether that's a person living with a handicap, whether that's a person coming from abroad, but that we are losing as humanity if we are losing a single person.
As you say, Pope Benedict himself wrote extensively about this issue in his encyclical. He also went in person, didn't he? He put his words into action, as it were, and went to visit a hostel run by Caritas here in Rome. What kind of reaction did you find that came about because of that?
I had the privilege to be present personally during that encounter here in Rome. And I saw some tears in the eyes of the homeless people, for example, when the Pope entered, when he was talking to those people, when he was listening very carefully, what that lady told him about her whole story when she was living for more than 20 years on the street. And I think that he was not only carefully listening, but that he was giving back some type of empathy, some type of solidarity, and all those people from the Termini station, they were really very moved when they had the opportunity to meet him. On the other hand, it was even possible to make an example in such a way that more than 100 bishops all over Europe did the same. So the action of the Pope meeting people in need was followed by more than 100 other diocesan bishops all over Europe. And we have plenty of testimonies coming from people who met bishops and bishops who met people in need. What is interesting, people in need, they were saying, that's interesting to talk to a bishop, because some bishops, they are very alone as well. So there was a kind of solidarity coming from that community back to the bishop, saying they are people in need, so to say, as well. And so they met in person. On the other way, it came back as a feedback from some bishops as well, that they were saying, isn't it interesting to meet people to whom you can speak directly? Because that's one of the advantages, talking to people who are poor. They have no time for diplomacy, so they have to go straight. If they want to talk about God, they will talk about God immediately, and not first talk about the weather, and then talking about other issues, and then slowly introducing maybe the subject of faith or God. But that's one of the big advantages, talking to people who we call poor.
Looking specifically at the question of those, the materially poor, those who really are living in extremely difficult conditions, it's true in Europe today we have a new category, the new poor, as we call them, people who in the past would simply never have had recourse to the services of Caritas, for example.
No, if you look at the economic and financial crisis we are facing in Europe and all over the world, then we are talking about the working poor. For example, there are a lot of people who are working daily, but the income they get for their work is not enough to survive in our very expensive environment. So that's a reality. Then you have a lot of people who lost their job. In Spain, for example, you have more than 20% of people without a job. That's enormous. So we have a new category of people entering into poverty who are highly skilled people, who are people willing to contribute to the common good in our society, but who are no longer allowed to do. So we have to reflect about different economics as well. There's one type of economy we call the solidarian economy. The Pope, he was quoting that in his encyclical as well, and he was referring to the gratitudinous, so being a gift and using gift as a possibility within economy. And I think we have really to reflect about a new way to do economy, to build our society, not only earning money, but giving services to the community, in the community. So this might change even the paradigm for economical work.
This is a particularly Christian vision. How much do you think this kind of idea can be a practical reality for the politicians, the policymakers?
I think it's more than a very Christian idea. It's a very human idea, because a lot of people are aware that they are instrumentalized in the current economy. So they don't want to be instrumentalized. And even our human rights are a very forceful instrument to show people, to make people aware that they should not instrumentalize other people. And of course, being not instrumentalized by other people or by other entities. So in this regard, I think it's a very universal idea to really leave this technical world and to go for a more human world.
In a time of financial crisis, though, when the leaders are trying to make the numbers meet, what kind of reception do you think this idea can have?
Nowadays, for example, Amartya Sen, Stiglitz and Fitoussi, two of them being Nobel Prize persons, they have developed a new instrument to measure the well-being. And measuring well-being cannot be done in a way we did it until now, just looking for the GDP. So they have presented a report to the French President Sarkozy, and that was received by the European Union as well. Now all the statistics in the world are trying to elaborate new instruments to measure the well-being. And if we are going for new instruments to measure well-being, this will change dramatically the framework of our perception. So, for example, when we only measured the GDP, Luxembourg, the country I'm coming from, was number very one. When then they added the Human Development Index, we suddenly were only number 17, because education in a lot of other countries was much better than in Luxembourg. So the instruments we are utilizing to measure wealth, to measure well-being, might change our perception. So it's interesting to follow that work of Sen and Stiglitz and Fitoussi.
Caritas has also just recently issued a new demand or a new request to governments to live up to the commitments on the Millennium Development Goals. We only have another 5 years to go. We don't look as though we're really on track in many areas.
No, it's very clear that we are running out of time when it comes to the Millennium Development Goals. And for the time being, I think it's very important to accept that the curve for the Millennium Goals has to go on. So it's now the time to reflect which type of commitment do we need for beyond 2015, because we know that it was a good instrument. It was one of the first times in the UN history where you had clear indicator you could measure, and there were only 8 goals put forward and not hundreds and hundreds of different goals. So having a very small framework where everybody can use all over the world, that's a helpful way to proceed. So we think it's now the time to begin to reflect how to continue that commitment the heads of state took in 2000 when they signed that Millennium Declaration.
What do you hope can be the biggest achievements of this plan? You say it was a very good idea. The instrument itself was very successful. How much has it actually achieved, though, for the poor of our world?
We know better how many poor people are existing in the different countries. We know that we did not succeed to reduce poverty at the level we agreed it should be reduced. So in that regard, it's a knowledge given to the international community, and we are facing our own commitments. And I think that's important, because if human people are making a commitment to the whole world, and this is what they did in the Millennium Declaration, then it should not be to come up with a new proposal and forgetting about the old commitments. And so having a time frame of 15 years with clear indicators, even so we failed, but at least we have to acknowledge that we had an idea not to fail, and then to analyze the causes why we failed in that, and why perhaps we have to change some indicators, but not now going for a complete new instrument, but really continuing with that instrument and requesting statistical analysis, so that we are not lying into our own pockets, as we say, but really facing the truth when it comes to the reality of poverty.
One of the underlying ideas behind the MDGs was that reducing poverty, increasing development is a benefit not just to the poor but also to the rich, in that it increases global stability. Do you think this idea has really got through or not?
I'm not sure. Let's say the 8th Millennium Goal is about international partnership. And I think the Global Forum, for example, is one answer from the civil society, where people are meeting in the World Social Forum or in the European and African Social Forum. And if you are looking at all those different fora, then you can see that a lot of Christian people are the builders and the drivers in those fora. And I think that's a real achievement, that we brought people together worldwide to talk and to share about their situations, because what is specific in our globalized world is that the north is in the south and the south is in the north, so we cannot make that divide. We thought you have the north and you have the south, and this is only possible if you bring people together so that they are becoming aware that there are very rich people living in Argentina, there are very rich people living in the Democratic Republic of Congo, there are of course very poor people living in London, there are very poor people living in Berlin. And making us aware as human beings that it's not an issue between countries, it's not an issue between rich and poor, but it's a matter for people, and we have to be careful not to be put into an ideology where suddenly we have the impression that we are the rich and others will have the impression we are the poor, and then building conflicts which are very bad for the evolution of our own humanity.
My thanks there to Father Ernie Gillen, President of Caritas Luxembourg and the Brussels-based Caritas Europa. And now we present the next instalment of our weekly radio drama, The Vatican Centuries, looking back at the people and places who made up the history of the Vatican. Episode 39 is entitled Secular Tides.
The cult of rationalism reached its peak sometime in the 18th century. Everywhere, men were rising against injustice, seeking equality, preaching freedom, the abolition of privileges, the rights of man.
Europe in the early 1700s was preoccupied with the wars of succession. It was the era of the professional soldier, and for Britain, the start of empire building. Canada fell to the British in 1759. Robert Clive won supremacy in India, and in 1770, Captain James Cook dropped anchor off the coast of Australia. The fifth continent was on the map.
Men were still pitting their strength against nature. Mont Blanc, the highest mountain in Europe, was scaled for the first time.
As the century advanced, a significant change was in progress. Industry no longer depended on manual labour alone. With the invention of James Watt's steam engine in 1769, mechanisation had arrived.
In the prevailing spirit of scepticism, Freemasonry was born. But paradoxically, it went hand in hand with an evangelical revival, the foundation of Methodism and the hymns of John Wesley. The first critical studies of the Bible also appeared at this time.
An age of wit and elegance, of lax morals, powdered wigs and painted faces, fluttering fans and coffee houses. The age of Casanova, but also of Dr. Johnson, of the political thought of Rousseau and the satire of Voltaire, of Haydn, Mozart, Handel and the soaring music of Bach.
For the papacy, it was a time of decadence and disintegration, and with the suppression of the Jesuits, the popes lost their last faithful ally.
Slowly, the world was moving towards secularization.
The 18th century was undistinguished in its popes, who were more involved in defending the papacy and keeping the papal states solvent than in undertaking any great enterprises. "I prefer to let the thunders of the Vatican rest," was the comment of Benedict XIV, who was well aware of the weakness of the papal position.
Benedict was elected after a six-month conclave, during which he remarked, "If you want a saint or a politician, elect someone else. If you want a good man, elect me."
The good man was elected and proved an enlightened ruler, doing a lot for the city of Rome. The Colosseum was constantly used as a quarry for travertine. Benedict saved the amphitheatre from total destruction. He had a cross erected in the centre and declared it a sacred place because of the blood of the Christians which had been spilt there.
By far the most formidable task confronting the popes of the time was the decision on the future of the Society of Jesus. For two centuries, the Jesuits had faithfully served the popes. They'd become a powerful force in the church and in the world. Confessors to kings and queens, their work in the missions was impressive, and their schools a byword. Their influence was worldwide. Since their obedience was directly to the Pope, they were not confined by national loyalties.
All these factors combined to make them steadily more unpopular with the enemies of the papacy. Their very success proved their downfall, and when reports of Jesuit intrigues began to circulate, the Great Society came under direct attack. Political groups outside the church, the Bourbon princes in particular, and the Jansenist party within, put pressure on successive popes.
Although the Society of Jesus was never officially condemned, it was systematically dismembered. Country after country closed its doors to the Jesuits. In the January of 1769, the Spanish, Neapolitan and French ambassadors in turn demanded that the Pope suppress the Society.
76-year-old Pope Clement XIII refused point blank, declaring that he would rather have both his hands cut off than do so. A few days after this encounter, the old Pope died of a heart attack. He'd just finished blessing the candles for Candlemas.
Clement XIV was elected Pope in May 1764, after a three-month conclave, during which voting was repeated 179 times. He was chosen because the cardinals representing the Bourbon courts believed he would suppress the Jesuits, while the others were sure he would not. Clement delayed decision as long as he dared.
But at last the papacy was forced to relinquish its closest ally. On July 21st, 1773, the Pope issued a brief suppressing the society. Subsequently, Clement lost interest in its fate, and shortly after his death, a year later, the Jesuit general, Father Lorenzo Ricci, died in imprisonment in Castel Sant'Angelo. On the 26th of July, 1770, Pope Clement received a young Austrian boy in private audience and conferred on him the Order of the Golden Spur. The boy who'd been so honoured was a 14-year-old musical prodigy from Salzburg. His name, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
Leopold Mozart and his son arrived in Rome on the Wednesday of Holy Week 1770. They went straight to the Sistine Chapel, where Allegri's Miserere was being played. Afterwards, Mozart wrote down the entire score from memory, to the amazement of all who heard of it. For the piece had not been published, and the singers had been forbidden to transcribe it, on pain of excommunication.
Mozart was born in 1756. At the age of four, he was playing the harpsichord and composing. 2 years later, his father took Wolfgang and his sister on the first of many musical tours. In Vienna, the Emperor Francis I sat beside him as he played, calling him his little magician.
But fate was not kind to Mozart. For most of his short adult life, he lived on the edge of bankruptcy and was buried in a pauper's grave. The day he died, it was raining, and his friends turned back at the city gates. Only his dog followed Mozart to his last resting place.
In a century rich in sublime music, Mozart was supreme. He lived only 35 years, but in that time wrote over 600 works, including 50 symphonies, 29 string quartets, 19 operas, and some 50 church works, of which 17 were masses, and his deathbed requiem, which he believed to be his own.
A few years earlier, a genius of quite another stamp was in Rome, Germany's greatest poet, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. He was present at one of the most popular of Roman festivals, the Feast of St. Peter and Paul. The following is an extract from his diary for the 30th of June, 1767.
The great feast of St. Peter and Paul has finally come. Last night we saw the illumination of the cupola, a sight resembling a fantastic legend. One can hardly believe one's eyes. The beautiful shape of the colonnade, of the church, and above all of the cupola, first sparkling with 1,000 burning lamps, and then, when the hour strikes, transformed into a feast of fire, is a unique and magnificent spectacle. The sky was pure and calm. The moon shone sweetly and poured what was like a luminous vapor onto the flames of the lamps. But at the end, when all became fire, the splendor of the moon was dimmed. It is only when we think that this enormous building at that moment serves only as a framework that we realize that nothing quite like it can be seen anywhere in the world.
You've been listening to episode 39 of The Vatican Centuries, written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. You can hear the next episode at this same time next week. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.